Welcome, everybody. Sorry for the couple minutes delay. I'm going to apologize in advance because I am expecting interruptions. My daughter's here. She's in the office watching TV. But she may visit us, so I'm apologizing in advance. Okay. So I think some of you were at my class a couple weeks ago for Shabbos Mevarchim at the Bengio's house. I think this is like really important, basic subject matter in terms of understanding the whole point of Sefer Shemot, so I decided to do it again because not everybody was there, but I didn't have time there to include like the third perspective, so I added that on. So for those of you who were there, you may be a little bored for the first half of this year, but then it will get interesting again. And now if you take notes, you can take notes because you couldn't take notes on Shabbos, so it's all good. So there are two different source sheets. Yes, exactly. Now it's recorded for everyone who missed it. That's a good point. There are two source sheets. One of them says Attaining Ma'alat Avotam, like that's with the title, with the chart on top. And then there's also a single sheet that has Sefer HaChinuch on it, which we're going to get to at the end. I also just didn't want to reprint everything because I still had these left over from Shabbos and I felt like chaval to waste paper. So that's why it's not all in one packet. Okay, so the Mishkan is essentially almost the entire second half of Sefer Shemot. If you look at the chart that I gave you on this page, this just shows us the second half of the Sefer starting at chapter 19, and it breaks down for us what the topics are that come up. So if you look, like starting with Parshat Yitro, we have Matan Torah and the Ten Commandments. And then we have this covenant that takes place in section B, right, at the end of Parshat Mishpatim, where Mishpatim, we get a whole slew of laws, right? And then at the end, there's this covenant that takes place, and then Moshe goes up on Har Sinai for 40 days. Then we get this commandment to build the Mishkan and a commandment of Shabbat. Then there's this interruption where we build this golden calf, and there's everything kind of falls apart. And then there's a new, right, Moshe begs for forgiveness. This is already section D, and we create a new covenant with Hashem. And then we get the commandment of Shabbat again, and we actually build the Mishkan. So if you look at this carefully, it actually takes up like 11 chapters are focused on the building of the Mishkan, which is more than a quarter of the entire book of Shemot. So I feel it's really important for us to understand what's the deal with the Mishkan. Like, first of all, there's a big question of, well, why would the Torah spend so much time focusing on this, especially because it tells us all about how to build it, and then it tells us how they built it. It could have just said, and they did it. It didn't need to repeat details again. Some stuff is sort of different and new, but a lot of it is repetitive. So it definitely could have been done more concisely. So there must be a reason why the Torah is so focused on it. And I think really there are lots of different answers we could give to that. But at the end of the day, there must be some major significance to this Mishkan. And we know that it's very significant. It's significant to our prayers nowadays. Tisha B'Av is all focused on it, right? Everything. We sort of focus on this ideal of getting back to Yerushalayim, back to the Beit HaMikdash, reinstating Korbanot. Like, it's so central to our religion nowadays, even though it's not part of our practice. We still focus on it a lot. There must be something about the Mishkan that is very central. So I wanted to look a little bit at how the Rishonim sort of understand what's going on in this section of Sefer Shemot in order to get a better understanding of what the Mishkan really is. So the first source I gave you on the top of the page is just where we get the main commandment, where it says, "Ve'asu li mikdash v'shachanti betzocham," right? Let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them. And really, I would say the crux of the argument that's going to take place between the different commentators we're going to look at today really comes down to what does it mean for Hashem to dwell among us? What is that concept, right? And which is a complicated concept, because if he's only spiritual and not physical, how can he dwell among us? What does it mean that he's dwelling among us? Can we see him? Can we feel him? Can we engage with him? Like, what does all that look like? So I think that that's really like the basis of their disagreement. So if you look at source number two, I brought you this Rashi. There's also, just so you know, a Rashi in Devarim. I wrote down the exact resource for it, but I don't have it in front of me right now. I'm sure I'll come across it in a second and then I'll tell you. But there's also Rashi and Devarim where he actually explains this again, where he sort of goes through the dates of when he thinks everything happens. And according to Rashi, Moshe goes up onto Har Sinai three times. He goes up the first time to get the first set of the tablets. He goes up a second time to pray for forgiveness. And he goes up a third time to get the second set of the tablets. And he sort of goes through the chronology. In the Midrash and Tanhuma, which he seems to be pulling from, it goes through this chronology as well. So that seems to be Rashi's source for all this. But what Rashi seems to be saying here, which we're going to read inside in a second, is here. Now I have the source. It is Devarim. anybody who wants to write it down. Devarim Tet Yodchet 9:18, where he goes through the sort of chronology of date by date. He says that the Luchot, he was up the first time to get the Luchot from the 7th of Sivan, which is the day after Shavuot, right? Until Yud Zayin B'Tammuz, which is the day that we know that the tablets were broken, which is the fast of Tammuz nowadays. We fast on that date, and there are a bunch of different reasons we fast, one of the reasons being that the tablets were shattered on that day. Then he says he goes back up on Yudchet Tammuz. So he comes down, he shatters the Luchot. Next day he goes right back up. He's there for 40 days from Yudchet Tammuz, the 18th of Tammuz, until Kafchet Av. And then he's davening that Hashem should forgive the people for the sin of the calf. Comes back down again, goes back up the next day on Chavtet Av to get the second set of Luchot, and he's there until the 10th of Tishrei, which is, what's on the 10th of Tishrei? Yom Kippur, right? So when he comes with the second set of Luchot, that ultimately becomes the day that forever will be the day of forgiveness. Once Hashem gives us that second set of Luchot, it's sort of like signing and sealing the fact that he's forgiven us for the act of the golden calf, and we're ready to move forward with a new set of Luchot. We're ready to repair the damage that's been done and move forwards. So that is sort of the chronology. Rashi got that from the Midrash in Tanchuma, and he gives it to us in Devarim. But here he says, in a bit of a more concise way, he says, V'yiten al Moshe, Ein muktamu mulchar b'Torah. He says there is no earlier or later in the Torah. This is a very central concept in commentary on Tanakh about whether or not you can read the Torah out of order. And for Rashi, he has no problem with it. He's not going to read like Pasuk 1 and Pasuk Bet out of order, but he'll take full paragraphs. The Torah has like sort of open paragraphs and closed paragraphs. He will rearrange those, and he's comfortable with doing that. Ramban, we're going to see later, is not comfortable with doing that. He feels that however the Torah lays it out for us is exactly how it happened chronologically, and that's really a big debate between the two of them, because if you're willing to rearrange things, then you can totally understand things in a very different way. So what does he say? There's no earlier and later in the Torah. Maaseh ha'egel, the act of the golden calf, kodem letzivui melech ha'mishkan, yamim rabim haya. The act of the golden calf was before the commandment of building the Mishkan by many days. Now, if you look back at this chart I gave you, that's not true in the way that the Torah is written, right? We got the commandment to build the Mishkan in section C in chapters 25 to 31, and we only had the golden calf built in chapter 32. But Rashi's saying, no, the commandment to build the Egel, sorry, came many days before the commandment to build this Mishkan. Sheharei b'yod zayin b'tamuz nishdabru haluchot, right, on the 17th of Tammuz, the tablets were broken. V'v'yom ha-kippurim nitratzeh ha-kadosh baruch hu li-Yisrael. And on Yom Kippur, Hashem was sort of reconciled with the Jews. V'lumacharat, and the very next day, hichilu minidvat ha-mishkan v'hu kam b'chad b'nisan. And the very next day, they started to donate their things for the Mishkan, and they started to, and it was finally sort of established and erected on the first day of Nisan. That was when we actually dedicated it.
So after Yom Kippur, from between Yom Kippur to the first of Nisan is when they were building.
Exactly. They needed to bring the materials and then start building it, right? And the Midrash in Tanchuma, which is in Ki Tisa Lamed Aleph, it's a long Midrash. I didn't end up printing it for you because it just felt like it was kind of redundant, but it says at the very end, it says, it goes through each of these dates, which Rashi sort of is basing all of this off of. V'kva'o HaKadosh Baruch Hu Slicha Mechila. Hashem makes this day, referring to the 10th of Tishrei, Yom Kippur, as a day of forgiveness and what's the other word? Pardon, ledorot, for generations. Shenemar ki biyom hazeh yachaper aleichem letaher etchem, right? Because it says in Biyakra that this day will be there for you to atone for you and to purify you. Umiyad siva lo lemoshe, and right after this, right away, he commanded Moshe v'asu limikdash. So the Midrash is saying, right after Hashem forgave them and they experienced their first ever Yom Kippur, Hashem right away turned and said, go and build for me the mikdash. So what do we get from that, right? So this came up in my shiur when I gave it on Shabbos. Somebody came up to me afterwards and said, like, it's not so clear to me what you're saying, and I think it's fair, but I found a sforno who agrees with me, so I'm going to go with it. So Rashi seems to be implying, right? He's choosing to read the Torah out of order. He didn't have to quote this Midrash. He could have ignored it. He ignores half most of Midrashim that exist, right? He chose to quote this Midrash, and he's saying that the Torah is written out of order. Now, why is it written out of order is a whole other conversation that we could have. But for him, the Mishkan, the whole concept of building the Mishkan, only came after the Egel happened. And the implication of this could be that the Mishkan is a response to the Egel. Right? Why would it be a response? Based on what we spoke about a couple weeks ago about what the whole business was with the Egel, the Jewish people were expressing a physical need to connect to God. And God wakes up and says, okay, you need something physical, fine, you can do it, but on my terms. Here are the exact dimensions, here's the exact way to build it, the exact way to, what materials to use, exactly who should do it and how they should do it. It's very, very, very clearly delineated for us exactly what to do, but because it's coming from God, the fact that we have this physical thing is okay, right? The Kuzari spoke about this, Nechama Leavitt spoke about this, we quoted all those ideas, but all of those concepts are based on this idea that somehow the Mishkan is responsive to the sin of the calf. But that raises a lot of questions, because if the Mishkan and the Beit HaMikdash is like the whole point of our Jewish experience, how could it be an afterthought, right? It's almost like, how could it be that if things would have gone better, we never would have had to build it? So that's the big question. So Sforno, who I regret not printing it for you, but truth is the English translation I found online last night was so terrible, and I didn't have time to like really work through it and translate it myself, so I'm almost glad I didn't give it to you, because it's like awful. But Sforno says on this same pasuk that Rashi is commenting on, right around there, he talks about this, and he specifically says, the Mishkan was there because the Egel happened, but he says it was supposed to be, the original plan was that there would be some concept of a Mishkan type thing, but it was going to be in everyone's home. It was going to be more individualized. It was going to be something that everybody would sort of have for themselves. People would be able to connect on their personal level. It wouldn't be this big, grandiose sort of structure that took all this time and money and energy to build. But there would be some level of being able to connect to Hashem personally without the need for this national sort of monument that had to exist. And so that's what the Sforno understands. And I think he sort of spells out, because he specifically says, but then they did the Egel, so they had to build the Mishkan. That's how he says it. It's almost like they forced it upon Hashem that they needed this bigger thing, because they showed this need for something physical to be able to come together and do things in a bigger, grander, more physical way. So that's Rashi's perspective. Sforno, and Rashi, who seems to imply it but never spells it out for us, but he's basing it off of this Midrash in Tanhuma, which also clearly says that the Mishkan came right after Yom Kippur, and so it's not a far stretch of your imagination to say that Rashi might have actually thought that the Mishkan was a response to the Egel, but he doesn't ever say it outright in his commentary. So for people who are not comfortable with Rashi saying that, you could say he's not saying that. So I'll give it to you.
It could also be not just a physical way, but a communal way.
Right. So exactly. Based on what the Sforno says, it seems to be not just about physicality, but also about something communal. Yeah, for sure. Which is interesting, because in the Midbar, they're all right around the corner. But then once they get to Eretz Yisrael, like, you could live like a couple days' journey from this Mishkan. So what does that look like in your day-to-day life? Like, you're not experiencing, you might, if you happen to live nearby, then it might be something you experience more regularly. But if you only go 3 times a year for like the Shelesh Regalim, like, it's not an experience that you're really having in your day-to-day life. So we have shul nowadays. They didn't really have shul. So what did it look like for them? It's very different, which is probably what led them to build these bumot and get us kicked out. So exactly. So it's sort of interesting how it sort of evolves, right? But at this point, they're all camped right around it. It's right in the center. It's the centerpiece of the encampment in the desert. At the beginning of Bamidbar, it lays out for us exactly which tribe was camped where and how it was all set up. But the Mishkan was right in the center. It was sort of the centerpiece of, and the focal point of the Jews.
So when we learn Malachim and the northern kingdom, southern kingdom, people did build their individual bamot
right
in their own.
Right, but they weren't supposed to.
Right, but there was no Beit HaMikdash
right
in the northern.
And they were expressing a need, 100%. Right, 100%. They needed something. Right. Right, it could be. I would have to look and see if the Sforno talks about the Bamot there in some way connecting it to. That would be very cool. I hadn't looked at him at all. I don't even know if there is. Is there Sforno in Malachim? I would have to check. I have no idea. I'm not super well-versed in Nevi'im. I kind of missed that part of my education. Labor Zionists don't believe in Nevi'im, apparently. Okay, so the Ramban is going to argue very strongly against Rashi's perspective, but he's also going to argue for us against the Rambam. So I brought you a couple pieces of the Rambam just to show you what the Rambam says. We're ultimately going to really focus on what Ramban says, but I wanted to see a little bit of where he's responding to. The Ramban lived after Rashi and after Rambam. He had both of them when he was writing his commentary. So he often quotes them and then either agrees or disagrees with them. Usually he disagrees with Rashi. Sometimes he quotes the Rambam to back him up. Sometimes he disagrees with the Rambam. So the Rambam is coming from the Spanish philosophical camp, which is very rationalist. Ramban was more of a Kabbalist. So that is where they're going to sort of kind of disagree with each other. They're going to have different perspectives. But the Rambam is coming from that rationalist camp. So he's going to have a big issue with this concept of God dwelling in the Mishkan, right? If you're a total rationalist and God cannot be physical, then what does it mean for him to dwell in your Mishkan? Like, what does that look like? So the Rambam, if you look at how he describes in source number 3, in Sefer HaMitzvot, he describes for us the mitzvah of building the Mishkan. So who should see Vanu Livnot Beit HaBechirela Avodah? Okay, this is the mitzvah that we have to build this sanctuary. Why? To serve God, to do our worship service there. Bo'yihiyah HaKrava, there we will do the sacrifices, v'havarat ha'esh tamid, and this building of the eternal flame, v'elav tihiyah ha'halicha v'ha'aliyah l'regel, and we will have the going up the 3 times a year for the festivals, v'ha'kibbutz b'chol shana, the gathering every year, v'hu amro yitzaleh v'asuli mikdash, and this is what Hashem says when he says in this pasuk that we quoted above, v'asuli mikdash, that you should make for me a sanctuary. So the Rambam seems to be implying that the Mishkan, yes, it has kedusha in and of itself, but the Mishkan is there to serve a purpose. It's just a location for us to go to be able to engage in our worship of Hashem. It's not necessarily, doesn't sound like the Mishkan itself is necessarily important to him so much as it is a location to go to. So the analogy I gave when I gave the shiur the other day, which is not mine, it's from all of this whole shiur is from a class I took at Stern with Rabbi Dr. Mordechai Cohen, and he gave the analogy that for the Rambam, the Mishkan is God's office. That's like where you go to meet with God, right? It's like a very functional sort of basic purpose. Not a lot of emotion attached to it. It's physical. The Mishkan is physical, and you go there to do korbanot, to like ask for forgiveness, to celebrate the holidays. It's just there to serve a purpose, right? And that's like these 4 walls, and yes, there are details, and there is kedusha in it, there is holiness in it, but it doesn't necessarily have, like, if Hashem would have decided to do it differently, like the Rambam wouldn't really care, right? Like to him, it's just serving a purpose. So the question that comes up is, how does the Rambam explain this idea of God dwelling? What does it mean that Hashem's, right, dwelling in the Mishkan? So I brought for you in Mor Nevuchim, the first part of Mor Nevuchim, the God of the Perplexed, is actually a dictionary where the Rambam goes through different terms from Tanakh and defines them for us, the way he understands them. He gets very philosophical in the context of this dictionary, but it literally is set up like a dictionary, like a term and his definition, and a term and his definition. So for the term of Kavod Hashem, the glory of God, which we, if you look at, sorry, I put it at the end, but source number 8, I believe it is, the very last source in this booklet, says, this is at the very end when they finally finished building the Mishkan. It says this cloud covered the tent of meeting, Ukvod Hashem alat Mishkan, and the glory of Hashem filled up the tabernacle, filled up the Mishkan, right? And also the same thing comes up, we're going to see the Rambam's going to quote in a second, at Har Sinai, that there is the Kvod Hashem, the glory of Hashem is on Har Sinai during the experience of getting the Torah. So he says, what is this Kvod Hashem? If you're a total rationalist and God can only be spiritual, what does it mean when it says that the Kvod Hashem comes? So what does he say? Yesh mekomot, there are places where hakavana bo ha'or hanivra. It's referring to this sort of material light. Asher Hashem meshre oto b'makom lechavod al derech hanes. That Hashem miraculously sort of causes to shine in order to sort of represent him. Kmo v'yishkon kvod Hashem al har Sinai, right? When it says that Hashem's glory sort of rested on Har Sinai, Uchvod Hashem alat Mishkan, and the glory of Hashem filled up the Mishkan. And then he says the second definition, V'yesh HaKavna, and there are times when it means, Atzmo Yitzalev Amitato, when it actually refers to God himself. But when does it refer to God himself, as opposed to referring to this light that represents God? Kmo, She'amar Moshe, Harinu Nad Kvodecha, Hashem says to, Moshe says to Hashem, please show me your glory. Uva'a HaTshuva, and what is the answer that Hashem gives to him? Ki lo yirani ha'adam v'chai. A man cannot see me and live. The only time he gives us a definition that the glory of God actually means God himself is when Hashem's response is no, right? Meaning, you can't see me. Yes, the term can refer to seeing God, but it can't actually happen. So when it happens, it's a reference to this light that sort of shines that somehow represents God. And
Moshe,
that,
right, didn't Moshe, like,
he hides under the rock, right. Hashem covers him, he passes him by, right, that whole...
He said to Moshe, you can't see my face, you can only see my back.
Mm-hmm.
But then also...
That's where this quote is from.
Also, Moshe, like, gets this, like, aura, this light.
Exactly, right, and he comes down and he's shining, right, and they can never look at him the same way, right. Yeah. So it seems like for the Rambam, the only time that it can refer to God himself is when it's not going to work, when it's not going to happen. In this world, we can't see God. He can't come into this world. This world is physical. God is spiritual. They can't mix. That's the Rambam. Okay, that's how he understands things. So let's turn now to the Ramban. So what I brought for you in the Ramban are two... Oh, sorry. First, I always forget this source because it never used to be in my source packet. Okay, source number five. This is the Ramban. He says, V'chas v'shalom, God forbid, shehiyeh ha-davar ha-nikra shechina, o kavod, that the thing that we call shechina, which means like Hashem's presence, I guess, is the best translation for it, but it's a name for God, or glory, nivra chutz me'Hashem enichbad yitbarach. He said, chas v'shalom, that should ever say that these words mean anything aside from God himself. Ka'asher chashav harav, meaning the Rambam, as Rambam thought, piprakim rabbi misifro, where the Rambam wrote many times in his book, meaning the Ramban is coming out here and saying outright, I disagree. This is not something representing God. When the Torah says that God's there, God is there. You can't tell me he's not. That's the Ramban. And for the Ramban, with a Kabbalist perspective, the concept of spirituality coming into the physical world is not as difficult for him. How it works and why it works, I can't tell you. Kabbalah is like well beyond my purview. But for the Ramban, it's a thing. So for him, it's not a problem to him. It's not a contradiction to say that God is in the Mishkan. For him, that makes sense. So what I brought for you are two separate pieces of the Ramban. The Ramban has, he does this in other places, but in Book of Shmot, the Ramban has an introduction to the book on a whole, and he also writes an introduction at the beginning of Parshat Truma. Parshat Truma is the first place where we first get the commandment about building the Mishkan. And before he goes line by line and gives us a commentary on things, he gives us an introduction, sort of laying out for us what he understands the Mishkan to be, and why we have it, and what's the importance of it, and sort of laying out his philosophy on the Mishkan. So I brought you here source 6 and 7. The 6 is the introduction to Sefer Shmot. It's not the whole thing. And 7 is parts of his introduction to Truma. What I'm actually going to have you do, and I apologize for this, we're going to do some of 7, and then we're going to jump back to source 6 again. So turn to source 7. So this is where the Ramban sort of lays out for us why it is and how it is that we got to this point. Now remember, the Ramban is not comfortable with reading the Torah out of order. So for him, we got the mitzvah of building the Mishkan, we had the Egel, and then we built the Mishkan. Okay, so that's the Ramban's layout of what happened. Okay, so look at source number 7. Kasher diber Hashem im Yisrael panim bepanim. Once Hashem spoke to the Jewish people face to face, aseret hadibrot, he gave us the Ten Commandments, v'tziva otam al yedei Moshe, k'tzat mitzvot shehem k'mo avot l'mitzvoteh shel Torah, and then he commanded us through Moshe, some mitzvot, which were sort of like the major categories of the Torah. That's referring to Parshat Mishpatim, where we get like a whole slew of laws. We get lots of social justice laws, we get some laws about the holidays. We get a sort of like sampling of what's to come in terms of the laws of the Torah. And then he says, V'Yisrael kiblu aleim lasot kol ma sheyetzavem al yado shel Moshe, and the Jewish people accepted upon themselves to do everything that Moshe had commanded them, v'kareti mehem brit al kol zeh, and Hashem made a covenant with us on all this. So he just laid out for us three sort of conditions. He said, first, Hashem spoke to us face to face and gave us the Ten Commandments. Then we got more mitzvot through Moshe, like a sampling of what we needed to do. And then we got... And then we created a new breed. Okay, all of that happened in up till chapter from 19 to 24, all in order. Okay, the line I skipped, which is important, he says, "V'tzivah otam al yedei Moshe k'tzat mitzvot shem k'vot avot l'mitzvoteh shel Torah." He gave us these mitzvot, which were sort of the general categories of mitzvot. Kasher hinigu rabotenu im hagerim shebaim lehitiyahed, just like our rabbis act with somebody who comes to them who would like to convert. So just like when somebody comes to convert, they're not required to learn the entire corpus of Torah, but they need to know the general gist of the big mitzvot in order to sign on, right? They can't say, yeah, I want to be Jewish and I'm going to do this and not know what they're getting into. So the rabbis make sure they understand what is going on. Even if they don't know every last detail, they have to have a basic understanding of what Shabbos looks like, what Kashrus looks like, what Taras Mishpacha looks like. They can't sign on without knowing those things, right? So that's... The Ramban is drawing this comparison, and it's not an accident, because I think what he's setting up for us is that the Jewish people went through their conversion process at Har Sinai. Only once we went through the experience of encountering God, speaking to him face to face, getting a sampling of mitzvot, and signing on the dotted line in chapter 24 and saying, we're in it, we want to do this, only at that point could we then receive our Mishkan. Okay, and that's what he's going to say.
Is that why people are saying that Esav was not Jewish? Because Hamet comes from Esav, and that he's not Jewish. Because we don't accept the fact that we were all Jews until we got to Har Sinai.
I mean, I don't know if everyone agrees with the Ramban, but I think the Ramban might agree with you. I'm not sure.
Because yeah. I like that answer.
Yeah. So what does he say? Right, he says, so we got all of these, and we gave this commandment. Me'ata, this is the line I underlined right in the middle of the paragraph, in source number 7, first paragraph. Me'ata, from this point, hine hem lo la'am, we are his nation, v'hu lahem le'elohim, and he is our God. Kasher hitzna'i mehem mitchila, just like he sort of made a condition with us from the beginning. When he said to us, if you will listen to me, if you will hear my voice, if you will keep my covenant, and you will be my treasured nation. Then he also said, you will be my kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Vehine hem kedoshim, and this is the next underlined section. They are holy, reuyim, fitting. Shehiye behem mikdash lehashroch shchinato b'nehem. They are deserving of having the shchina come into their mists. Only once we went through our Har Sinai experience do we get to have a mishkan. And for the Ramban, we're going to see in a second, the whole point of getting out of Egypt wasn't to get the Torah, but it was to get the mishkan. He wanted us to get back to the state of having Hashem among us. And that's why the first thing we got after that whole conversion process, the first mitzvah we got was build the Mishkan. That they should have a house within them that is sanctified for his name. And there he would speak to Moshe and give commandments to Israel. And the main point or main objective of the Mishkan, a place for the Shechina to rest or to dwell. Shehu Ha'aron, that this is what happened in the Ark, which was inside the Kodesh HaKodashim, which was surrounded by one set of curtains, and then there was more walls. It was like the inner chamber of the Mishkan is where this presence was. Okay, so that is the Ramban's introduction to what the Mishkan is. So let's turn back quickly to source number 6, and this is his introduction to the whole book of Shemot, where he's going to lay out for us the book of Shemot. So he's going to start by explaining why we're at a new book. So he says, Hishlim HaKatuv Sefer Bereishit, the text has completed the book of Bereishit, Shehu Sefer Yetzirah, which is the book of creation, Bechidush HaOlam, V'Yetzirat Kol Notzar, where it talks about the creation of the world and the fashioning of every creation, U'V'Mikrei HaAvot Shehem Ki Inyan Yetzirah Lezar'am, and also the stories of the Avot, which is sort of like creation in regard to the Jewish people. So it fits into Bereishit because it's all creation, creation on a larger scale and creation within the Jewish nation. So it's all part of Sefer Yetzirah. Because this is all the things that happened to the forefathers are all illustrations that are sort of going to hint for us what's going to happen in the future to their children. And this is a big theme in the Ramban, where he always sort of says that things that happened in earlier generations are sort of laying out the path or the sign for the future generations. When Ramban goes to Egypt with Sarah during the famine, that's what causes us to go to Egypt later, right? The Ramban is very into this sort of mirroring that happens from the earlier generations to the later generations. And after completed with the account of creation, hitchil sefer acher, it's going to start a new book. It's going to start a new book about the topic of the things that were hinted to in the earlier book, right? In the earlier book, we got all of the foundation for the stories of going down to Egypt, of having slavery, of being redeemed. And so now we're going to spell it out for ourselves in the next book. V'nitichet sefer ve'ela shmot. And sefer shmot is unified, beinyan hagalut harishon hinigzar beferush uvegeula mimenu. It is the book that is all about the first exile that was sort of decreed upon us, and the redemption from that exile, right? Which in short form he would say that the book of Bereishit is the book of creation, the book of Shemot is the book of galut and geula, exile and redemption. And that's why it starts off again telling us all the names of the people who went down to Egypt and how many there were. Even though it already said it in Bereishit, but avur ki rida tam sham hu reishit hagalut ki me'az huchal. Because it's the beginning of a book. He's seeing it as a literary unit. You can't start in the middle of a story. The beginning of the story of the exile in Egypt is going to Egypt. So it's going to start off again and repeat some things, because just like if you're, you know, reading like book number 2 of Harry Potter, it needs to like give you some of the introductory stuff. We're in Harry Potter mode in our house these days. You need to do some of the introductory stuff and remind you who Harry is, who his aunt and uncle are, just in case you didn't read the first book or you forgot about the first book. We're going to give you a little bit of a reminder of where we're at in book number 2. Because that's where it all started from, right? V'hine hagalut einenu nishlam. We're in paragraph 3 where I underlined. The exile was not finished. Ad yom shuvam el mekomam ve'el ma'alat avotam yeshuvu. It was not completed until the day that they returned to their place and to the level of their forefathers. Well, spell that out in a minute. V'kishiyatsumi Mitzrayim, and when they came out of Egypt, afal pishiyatsumi beit avadim, even though they had already left the house of slavery, adayin yechshavu golim, they were still considered exiled, ki hayu ba'aretz lo lahem nevuchim b'midbar, because they were still in a land that wasn't theirs, wandering in the desert. V'kishibau el har sinai, v'asu hamishkan, when they got to har sinai and made the mishkan, v'shav ha-kadosh baruch hu, v'hashresh chinato b'neihem, and Hashem returned, and he... what's the hashra? He caused his shechina to dwell among them, I guess. As shavu el ma'alat avotam. At that point, they had finally gotten back to the level of their forefathers. So in the paragraph before, he said, what are the two conditions to finally being redeemed? Getting back to our land or our place and being back on the level of the forefathers. When are we on the level of the forefathers? When we got the shechina back. Shehaya sod elokam aleo ohalehem v'hu hem hem hamerkava. The forefathers had this secret of God or this presence of God resting over their tents, and they were the merkava, which is a midrashic idea that they were the divine chariot, that they brought God's presence into the world. Abraham and Yitzchak and Yaakov and the Imahot were bringing God into the world. They went down to Egypt. They kind of lost the presence of God because of all the negativity that was going on there, and when they came out of Egypt and they built this Mishkan and Hashem's presence came back, they're now the chariot again. They're back at where the forefathers were because they're bringing God into this world. And so they're back on the level of the forefathers. V'az nechshavu ge'ulim. And now they're considered to be redeemed. V'lachen nishlam ha-sefer hazeh b'hashlimo inyan ha-mishkan. That's why this book completes with the topic of the Mishkan, uveyot kvod Hashem aleo totamid, and with God's presence filling it always. The very end of Sefer Shemot is where they finish building the Mishkan, they put it up, and God comes and into the Mishkan, right? He finally comes home. So for the Ramban, you would say, if this is the book of Golut and Geulah, if you hadn't read this, you would say, okay, well then why doesn't it end like at Har Sinai? Like they get out, they pass through the Yamsuf, they're like already, they got to their Torah, that's where they were planning to go. Like, why don't we just pick up in Vayikra or Bamidbar with the rest of the story of the Mishkan? If anything, Mishkan kind of does fit in Vayikra because it's all about all the sacrifices and what the priests have to do, right? So why isn't the second half of Sefer Shemot in Shemot? But for Ramban, the second half of Sefer Shemot is the whole point of Shemot. For him, the climax is not getting the Torah. The climax is building the Mishkan. The Torah is just sort of like a means to an end. We had to go through Matan Torah in order to be deserving of building this Mishkan. If we didn't have Matan Torah, we couldn't have a Mishkan, but the whole point of being there is to get the Mishkan. The only question we have on the Ramban is he said there were two conditions. One was getting home, and the other was getting the Mishkan. And we got the Mishkan, but by the end of Sefer Shemot, we're not home. So I think that's a good question on him. It could be, you know, it's just sometimes you need to end with a cliffhanger and pick up in the next book or three books later. But the Rabbi Riskin actually speaks about this, and he has a piece where he says that he thinks that for the Ramban, the Kedusha of the Mishkan is sort of parallel to the Kedusha of the land of Israel. And even though they're not home yet, once they have the Mishkan and they have their encampment and they're sort of set up like a nation, they're home even though they're not home. Which is sort of a nice idea because it does fit with the Ramban. We're going to flip back now to source number 7 and read the end of what he says. And we'll see that that does fit really nicely. So he says, we're in the second paragraph of source 7. The secret of the Mishkan is that the glory, right, which is that term that Rambam was very, very careful to explain not being God, right? Ramban is going to say it is. That the glory that rested on Har Sinai rested inside the Mishkan in a more hidden way. Just like it said there, that the glory of Hashem rested on Har Sinai, and it's written here, Hanarenu Hashem Elokeinu et kvodo et gadlo, when they say in Devarim that God showed us his glory and his greatness, Ken katsuv b'mishkan, it says in the Mishkan, kvod Hashem alat mishkan, and the glory of Hashem filled the Mishkan. V'haya b'mishkan tamid im Yisrael hakavod shenir alehem b'Har Sinai. The glory of God that appeared to them at Har Sinai was with them all the time in the Mishkan. And when Moshe would go there, that's where he would speak to Hashem. What is the Ramban saying? The Mishkan is, who's at my shir on Shabbos, you remember what I said? Har Sinai to go, right? It's like you take it with you. Har Sinai was this unbelievable, inspirational, amazing experience that the Jewish people had, but they couldn't take it with them. It was on a mountain. It was stuck there. It couldn't come with them. And they couldn't live in the Har Sinai experience on a day-to-day basis. It's not sustainable to live that kind of a lifestyle. They needed to separate from their wives. They needed to be pure. They were like overwhelmed. They all died and came back to life. It was like too much for them. It was like a one-time deal and they couldn't do it anymore. But they needed something like that to come with them. So what was the Mishkan? It was a little mini Har Sinai that they could pack up and the Levium could carry on their shoulders. And when they got to the next place, they could put it up again and they would have it. And it was sort of their go-to place for spiritual inspiration that they always had available to them, but it wasn't as intense and crazy as the Har Sinai experience. It was inside the Mishkan. It was hidden by the curtains and the walls and everything. So they were able to live their lives while having the Mishkan in the center of their camp. And so it was really their Har Sinai on wheels. And when Moshe used to go up to Har Sinai to talk to God, so now he goes to the Ohel Moed, to the tent of meeting in the Mishkan to talk to God. So it was just a sort of an extension of what they had coming along with them. So that's the Ramban. So for Ramban, remember we said that for the Ramban, the Mishkan was God's office. For the Ramban, the Mishkan is like God's home. That's like where Hashem lives. And it's the whole point of everything. We left Egypt just for this. This is why we did it. This is what we wanted, right? Like, it wasn't just about getting the Torah. The Torah wasn't good enough. For Ramban, it's about a relationship with God. That was the whole reason why we left. And the relationship with God actually has this sort of physical form, which is so antithetical to everything we've always learned about, like, Hashem can't be physical, Hashem can't be physical. But the Ramban wasn't, like, the Rambam's rationalist tradition has really been ingrained in, like, modern Jewish thought. But before the Rambam, like, wrote that down, not everybody read things as metaphorical. Like, it wasn't considered heretical to be like God's hand and think of it as God's hand. Once the Rambam said it was, then we all were like, oh yeah, that kind of makes sense. We shouldn't really do that. And it's true. But for the Ramban, it doesn't mean he thinks God has a body, but he thinks that God can take on this physical form and he can be in this world. And that's like the whole point of everything. That's what we're supposed to do. He created this world so we would bring him into it. And that's like, for him, it's like, how could you say it's not God? Like, it's totally, for him, it's heretical to say otherwise, right? Because it's the whole purpose of creation is this moment when God finally comes back into the Mishkan. So that's the Ramban. That was where I ended off last Shabbos. What I brought for you on the other piece of paper I gave you is the Sefer HaChinuch. The Sefer HaChinuch has both the Rambam and Ramban and Rashi, I believe. And it's very, very long. This is mitzvah. Sefer HaChinuch, for those who aren't familiar, is basically a list of the mitzvot in order of the Torah. He goes through each parsha and he lists any mitzvot and codifies them in the order that they come in the parsha. If you have the Torah Chaim edition of the Chumash, which is excellent, that blue, navy blue tall one over there on the third shelf down, at the back, the Sefer HaChinuch is printed in there. That's divided up by the five books of the Torah, and the Sefer HaChinuch for each book is at the back of each one. It's a good edition, has some good footnotes. It's only in Hebrew, but it's excellent. But it's a really great way, I think, to learn Parsha. If you're like sort of over learning Parsha, but you want to learn Parsha, learn Sefer HaChinuch. I mean, the Bereishis is like pretty sparse, but once you get into things, there's a lot to learn. But here he speaks about the mitzvah of building this temple, right? We start off with the Mishkan, it turns into the Beis HaMikdash. So it was really long, so I just brought you little excerpts, but we'll go through it. What he says is very interesting. I think he's trying to deal with like the question the Ramban has, but also deal with the Rambam's like philosophical issue with God being physical, and he sort of comes up with a good new way of viewing it. Mitzvah binyan beit bechira. Okay, so this mitzvah of building this choice house is this English translation. Leave not bayit l'shem Hashem, right? We should build this home for God. Klomar shnihiyeh makrivim shem karbonotenu alav, that we should bring our sacrifices there. V'shem tihiyeh ha'aliyah l'regel, and there we will have our pilgrimage three times a year. V'kibbutz kol Yisrael b'chol shana, and we should gather every year. Does anybody think this sounds familiar? Where's the Sefer HaChinuch kind of quoting from? It's the Rambam. It's very, very similar to the Rambam's definition of the mitzvah as well. Shne'emar v'asuli mikdash. As it says, build for me a mikdash. V'zot ha-mitzvah kolelet ima ha-keilim ha-tzrichim b'bayit. This mitzvah includes within it all of the tools and vessels that needed to be built in the home, in the Beis HaMikdash, el ha-avodah, for the worship. Kagon ha-menorah, the ha-shulchan, just like the menorah and the table and the altar. V'kol shar ha-keilim kulam. And all the rest of the tools. So that's his sort of introductory paragraph where he summarizes the mitzvah. So he's also laying out for us, when it says, make the menorah, make the shulchan, he's not going to list those as separate mitzvot of the 613. He's including all of that under the heading of build the Beis HaMikdash, which makes sense. So now I skipped a bit here, but then he says, and sorry, I forgot to mention, this book was written for his child. The Sefer HaChinuch was written like for his son. He gave it to his son. So he often writes, and you should know my son, and listen my son. It's very cute. B'dabni, and you should know my son. Ki kol asher yagia etzel Hashem ba'asot b'nei adam kol mitzvotav einenu rak shechafetz Hashem lehitiv lanu. You should know that every mitzvah that Hashem gives us, everything that Hashem gives to us to do, is just for our own good. Uvehayot ha'adam mechsher u'muchan be'asiyat otan mitzvot. And when a person prepares himself and makes himself ready to do these mitzvot, l'kabel ha'tova az yetiv elav Hashem. Hashem will do good for him. When a person is ready to receive the good of God, God will do good for him. Be'al ken hodi'am derech tov l'hiyotam tovim. And therefore, Hashem teaches us the good way to be good, v'hi derech ha'torah. And this is what the Torah is all about. Now, the reason why he's bringing this up now, right, is sort of a question. Why would the Sefer HaChinuch feel it's necessary in the middle of talking about building the Mishkan that the Mishkan needs to be for us? So I think here is he's starting to argue against the Ramban. For the Ramban, the Mishkan is for God, right? Yes, we need it, but we're building him a house. He needs somewhere to live, and we're building him a house. He's saying, we can't have mitzvot that are for God. The mitzvot are for us. God gave us mitzvot to perfect us, to do good for us. This is all about us doing for ourselves. It's not, God doesn't need a house. God doesn't need us. He's telling us to do this because it's for ourselves. Okay, we skipped some more. Now we're going to continue. Umeata, we're in the sort of second paragraph. You know what? I have a different page than you guys, so I don't know exactly where it is on yours. Yours is all in one paper, right? Thank you. Okay, yeah. Second paragraph. We're good. Okay, we're after the space. Umeata, behayot hanachat da'atenu al zeh be'inyan mitzvotav baruch hu. Once we understand this about mitzvot, that they're all for us, techayev otanu, it is incumbent upon us, or we're obligated, le'amor, ki binyan bayit la'Hashem yitbarach la'asotenu batfilot v'karbonot alav, that when we build this Beis HaMikdash to be able to daven there and to bring sacrifices there, hakol ha'chin have levavot le'avoto yitaleh, it is all to prepare our hearts for the service of God. Lo mehayato tzarich l'shtevet bayit anashim v'levo betzel koratam. He doesn't need us to build him a house and to come under the shade of our beams that we constructed for him. V'imar zeh levanon yivnuhu, Berotim, like it doesn't matter what kind of wood we built it from, if it's from Lebanon trees or cypresses. Ki hashamayim v'shmei hashamayim lo yichalkaluhu v'ruach ya'amdu. That is a quote. I can't remember from where. I looked it up last night, but I forgot to write it down. The heavens, right, cannot contain him. Right? Hashem doesn't need somewhere to go because Hashem is like greater than everything. The heavens can't even contain him. Af ki habayit asher banu bnei ha'adam tzarich lichvodo chalilah. It's chas v'shalom that you should say that the house was built for God. Halo yodim hadvarim b'brurim shehakol lehachsher gufotenu. It's very clear that all of this is for the refinement of our own bodies. It's not for God, it's for ourselves. Ki hagufot yachshiru al yadei ha'pa'alot ve'uverabot ha'pa'alot ha'tovot uverav ha'tmanatan mechshavot ha'lev. Right, by all the good actions that we're going to do and being constant with it, sort of having consistency, and the good thoughts that we have will become purified and cleansed and sanitized, this translation says, which I'm not so fond of. But this is all for us. The reason why God told us to build this place is all for us. So last thing he says, v'al derech hapshat, and the simple explanation is, al hatzad hazeh nefaresh, shriyat hashchina, we need to explain, what does it mean that the shchina rested b'makom ahu, in this place? V'af al pi sheha'emet ki amru rabotenu zichronam livracha, kedushatan alehem afilu kashehen shomemin. There is the Chazal say in the Gemara and Megillah that the pieces of the Mishkan were holy even when they weren't being used, even when they were abandoned, even when we got kicked out. Like the Beis HaMikdash retains its holiness even when it's destroyed, right? The place where it was, we still view as holy. It's not like for the Rambam, it maybe wouldn't. I don't know what the Rambam says. It could be he talks about it. I haven't looked it up. I wouldn't even know where to look. But the Rambam, right, it was God's office. It was just a functional location for us to go and do our avoda, to go worship Hashem. But for him, he's saying, no, there is something about it that is holy in and of itself. Because even after we get kicked out of Israel or are no longer there or we're not interested, we're busy doing idol worship, it still retains its Kedusha, even if we're not using it for its functional purpose. And he says the simple meaning is shemashma bezeh she'ein kol sivat shriyat ha'shchina sham mitzad ha'ovdim. It's not that the shchina is resting there for the it's not that the whole reason of the shchina being there is just for us, right? There is something to be said about it, that there is somehow a reason for it being there. Af shalomar ki oto ha'makom bachru ha'kel yitbarach bnei adam asher baram imenu. Kmosha Marnu, that it's implying, right, that there's no reason, it's implying that there's no reason at all for the dwelling of the divine permanence from the side of the worshippers. If you say that these pieces of the Mishkan, even when they're not in use anymore, are still holy, then it makes it sound like it's not about us, it's about God, that God was there, so they're holy, right? So he's saying, so how could that be? So he says, because it must be that its purpose is there for, because it allowed us to have this taharat ha-machshava, this purifying of our hearts, purifying of our thoughts, the fixing of ourselves that we do through these actions, that's what creates this holiness for him. So he's sort of saying, what does Shriyat HaShchina mean? That it's not God dwelling in the Mishkan. It's the definition for him of God dwelling is us improving ourselves. And when we are getting better and we're becoming closer to God through our behavior and through our personal work that we do on ourselves, whether it's through the physical mitzvot or the spiritual mitzvot or the work on our midot that we do, we create a dwelling of God in this world, because the better we become, the more godly we become, and that brings God into this world. So he sort of avoids the question altogether of like God being physical in the Mishkan, not in the Mishkan, because for him it's not about that. The Mishkan is a functional place, just like for the Rambam, but it's not just so we can bring sacrifices. It's like it's there for a functional purpose of helping us get better and become better and refine ourselves and come closer to God. And through that experience and us becoming more godly, we will essentially be bringing God into this world. But not God himself, the way the Rambam understands. Because for the Sefer Chinuch, he can't do that because he's following the Rambam's understanding of things. But he's not really comfortable with the Rambam either, because he thinks the Rambam is almost like too clinical and unemotional, right? It's just this place to go do sacrifices. He's like, no, there's a reason for these sacrifices. What's the reason? The reason is our personal improvement, our personal working on ourselves through all these different mitzvot. It allows us to become more godly, which in turn is God resting in this world. It's way longer than this, and I only brought you little pieces, but the English translation is worth reading. It's not like literal, but it's pretty good. It's not mine. But basically, like, if you're not ready and you didn't prepare yourself, you're not going to get the experience that you need to get out of the Mishkan. For him, it's all about the personal work that you do. Wow. He keeps on saying over and over again, right? Preparing yourself, thinking about these things. The purpose of the mitzvot is for us to get better and better and better. But it takes work. It's not just like you just show up. It's like, you know, if we could imagine living at the time of the Beis Hamikdash, you could just show up on Erev Pesach to bring your Korban Pesach. If you didn't, like, think about it in advance and prepare for it and consider what it means to you and all of that, then, like, would it really have any meaning? Would it serve any purpose? For the Sefer Chinuch, I don't think so. If you didn't do the preparation, then it's sort of like you shouldn't even bother. So I think, you know, in our time, even though we're not doing these Korbanot and we're not going to the Beis Hamikdash, like, to recognize that idea of when we engage in mitzvot, to make sure that we're mindful about it and thoughtful about what it is we're doing and why we're doing it is so important. It's hard, especially when you're busy with the physical preparations for a specific holiday or whatever it is. It's very hard to make that time. On that note, I haven't booked anything yet, but before Pesach for the Eishes Chayil Initiative, I'm hoping to do a women's like Haggadah round robin thing so we can all spend one night preparing for the Seder without cooking, preparing for the actual Seder. So keep that in mind. It's just like a thought I've been having, but it totally fits with this idea that like making sure that you make the time in your life to make these mitzvot meaningful. Otherwise, what's the point of doing them? So I think I love the Sefer HaChinuch because he's sort of like dealing with both of the issues that Rambam and Ramban have, and he sort of found this creative solution to like stick with the philosophical tenet of God can't be physical. God doesn't live in the Mishkan. The Mishkan's not really for him, but also account for the emotional experience relationship part that the Ramban is focused on. Oh, good. We finished early. Yay. Mm-hmm. Any
this
questions?
Goes yeah. Back to, with her, of the Egel.
Mm-hmm.
The purpose of doing the Egel, that the people needed something tangible.
Yes, we talked about that at the beginning also.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That was approached.
Yeah.
No
but yeah, no, we definitely spoke
so
about
my
that.
Mind is
yes. Oh, this one?
Yeah.
No, this
yeah.
is not Maimonides. I can look. I can't remember who wrote it now. Everybody just calls him the Chinuch. This was not written by Maimonides, but he's quoting Maimonides.
Oh, there. Yeah.
Yeah. I will look up his name for you afterwards. It could be he's anonymous. I feel like this is the one that's anonymous and nobody knows who it was, but maybe I'm wrong. Thank you all for coming.